Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So we're here today with Dr. Tom O'Brien, who is going to be talking with us about autoimmune disease and functional medicine concepts. Tom was educated at the University of Michigan and then got his postgraduate work at the National College of Chiropractic in Chicago, where he's currently based. He's been a functional medicine practitioner since 1978, and he is currently on the teaching faculty at the Institute for Functional Medicine and also the National College of Chiropractic. Now, Tom, you were just telling me that you were one of the, the first class of doctors who heard that lecture by Jeff Bland back in 1978. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, well, Jeff came to Chicago. He would come to 8 different cities once a year, and Chicago was one of those cities, and he began in 1978, and I was a student at the National College at the time, and went because I didn't have anything else to do, and I didn't know who this person was, but was so startled and shocked by the quality of information and the vision, the visionary aspect of how he would look at these studies and what they meant and how he tied them together, that I've been hooked ever since in my career.
Well, it's a very, very useful way to approach all of the science. It gives you a nice fundamental structure that you can pin it onto that allows you to see how things interact in a way that I think for all of us has really revolutionized the way we look at nutrition and look at behavior. And that's certainly going to be a big piece of what we are talking about here today. You mentioned several statistics about autoimmune disease in your initial remarks that I found quite amazing. For one thing, you stated that the number of people with autoimmune disease greatly exceeds the number of people with cancer or heart disease.
Yes. We think of autoimmune diseases as separate, distinct diseases, such as psoriasis, and a few people will have lupus, a few will have rheumatoid arthritis, a few will have MS, multiple sclerosis, but the mechanism that causes these diseases is similar in all of them. And it just depends on the weak link in a chain. You know, you pull at a chain, it always breaks at the weakest link. It's at one end, the middle, the other end. It's always the weakest link. And that's determined by our genetics and what we've been exposed to in our lives, called the environmental triggers. And when you pull at a chain, where it breaks, the weak link. So for you, it might be your skin, and you get psoriasis. Or it might be your hair follicles, and you get alopecia. Or it might be your joints, and you get rheumatoid. Or it might be your liver, and you get autoimmune hepatitis. Or it might be your brain, and you get MS, or you get Alzheimer's. It just depends on where the weak links are and what environmental triggers you've been associated with. So when you look at autoimmune diseases as a whole, in 2006, the National Institute of Health told us that 9 million people had cancer, 22 million had heart disease, and 24 million had autoimmune diseases. But only 1 out of 3 are diagnosed with autoimmune diseases, which means there are 72 million people out there walking around with autoimmune diseases, and it's not looked for, it's not identified until those antibodies have caused so much tissue destruction that you've got symptoms now because of organ failure, what usually is permanent organ damage and then organ failure. Now here come the symptoms. Now we go to the doctors to try and get the diagnosis, and now we get identified with the autoimmune disease.
Often at that point, people are placed on medications which suppress the immune system. And we're now beginning to see, particularly with these strong drugs such as tumor necrosis factor, Remicade being a classic one, we're beginning to see increases in cancer risk because you can suppress the immune system a little too hard by using these powerful agents.
Yes, that's very true. And the concept of suppressing the immune system is trying to put a Band-Aid on an oozing wound while the person still has the lifestyle that's caused the problem in the first place. So the goal in our education is to, of course, use the medications as necessary for symptomatic relief and stabilization, but then identify the underlying mechanism triggering this process and address the underlying mechanism.
It seems as if autoimmune disease is at an absolute epidemic.
Is there a sense that it's more common now than it was 50 or 100 years ago?
Oh, yes, there's no question that the frequency is much higher. And the theory as to why is because of two things. One, we're genetically weaker than we have been in the past as a people. We know that for the first time in history, the current toddler generation has a shorter expected lifespan than their parents. And that's never happened before. And it's because of the lifestyles that we've lived and how they've weakened us and what we've passed on to our next generation and what the lifestyle that they're projected to be living with the quality of the foods and the toxic environment and all that. And autoimmune diseases occur as a result of three things. One, you have to be exposed to a trigger, an environmental trigger. And the easiest one to identify is the one that we know is the autoimmune disease that's directly associated with an environmental trigger, celiac disease. And the environmental trigger is wheat. Those that are allergic to wheat and eat wheat triggers this autoimmune process. So the first is the trigger. Two, it has to get into the bloodstream. And that's because of intestinal problems called intestinal permeability. And three, there has to be an immune reaction that occurs as a result of that. So the mechanism of autoimmune diseases is occurring because of the higher volume of toxic chemicals that we have and the increased vigilance of our immune system. The more children are being born with more, it's called antigenic load, from their mothers. They've inherited more antibodies and more sensitivities than their mother was born with.
I see. How does the gut affect autoimmunity? What is the mechanism for that process? How do we become sensitized? And what is it in the environment that sensitizes us outside of wheat?
That's a really good question. See, it would take 3 days to answer. Let's start with our skin has to stop substances. It's a barrier that stops substances from getting in the body. So it's a block. Our kidneys are tissue that has a barrier that allows certain substances to get through into the urine to be eliminated and other substances to stay in the bloodstream. So it's not a complete block. It's selective as to what it allows in and what it doesn't. Well, our intestines have to do both the job of being a block and the job of being selective of what gets into the bloodstream. Depending on the study, we eat somewhere between 3 and 7 tons of food in our lifetime. Tons of food. And as we know, most of the food we eat has some bacteria, some fungi, some molds in it, hopefully not too much, but we have some. And so the immune system in the gut has to be able to select what do we allow in, what do we not allow in to the bloodstream, what do we have to fight, what do we not have to fight. It's called oral tolerance. What do we tolerate? And what do we say, no, that's not okay to tolerate, we better attack that. Depending on the study, 57 to 70% of the immune system is in the gut, not in the bloodstream. So 57 to 70% of everything to fight cancer, colds, flus, viruses, parasites, is in the gut. So why would it be the most prevalent of all the immune system, the dominant immune system in the gut? Because that's where we get exposed to most of the things that are offensive that would be a problem for us, potentially a problem. So our immune system in the gut has to decide what's okay to let in and what's not. That's the first step. That wouldn't be an issue, except that we're exposing ourselves to things that shouldn't be allowed in every single day in terms of the foods that we've selected to eat. You know, you and I are supposed to be Tarzan and Jane. If you'd like to go swing on a vine with me, that'd be a lot of fun, right? But we're supposed to be Tarzan and Jane. We're supposed to eat the foods that grow on the planet, organic, healthy, vibrant foods. We're supposed to have very peaceful lives. We're supposed to graze all day and not gorge on 2 or 3 meals a day. But the foods we're supposed to be eating are healthy foods that grow on the planet. And we really weren't designed to eat Kraft cheese food, which doesn't have any cheese in it.
Nor were we designed to consume the compound that leaches from the plastic that the Kraft cheese food is wrapped in.
Right, that's called bisphenol A. And bisphenol A is the most ubiquitous chemical in the food chain. There's 3.7 million metric tons of it produced a year. And we now know that bisphenol A, articles came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association just a few months ago that showed that bisphenol A, molecule for molecule, is as potent as estrogen. It's an endocrine disrupting chemical or an estrogen mimic. And it binds to estrogen receptor sites and it acts like estrogens. It's as powerful as estradiol. And the mechanism of action of what it does is very similar to the chemical DES that was around back in the 60s and 70s and was given to pregnant women who had nausea. Now we know that those women who took DES, their offspring have much higher incidences of hormone-related cancers, much higher incidences. And that goes into the world of epigenetics. But let's go back to the colon, that these chemicals that we're exposed to every day, all the time, whether it's foods that we're sensitive to or these toxic chemicals, they tax the immune system of our gut. Where our immune system is supposed to be reacting on occasion to a bad parasite that's in the food and knocking out that parasite, the immune system's having to react with almost every meal every day. And it gets fatigued and it can't keep up. And what happens is we develop what's called intestinal permeability, or the slang term for it is leaky gut. And when we have intestinal permeability, that is the initiator of these molecules getting into the bloodstream, where the immune system in the bloodstream then has to take over, and it ends up as a mechanism of autoimmune disease.
Now, you had added a very interesting detail to the story of the tight junctions and the intracellular absorption and the things that managed to sneak in between the cells where the tight junctions have been damaged. And that was a protein called zonulin and its effect in the generation of immune reactions to compounds. It acts almost, I guess, like the antigen-presenting cell function of the macrophages in the immune system, the lymph nodes, it seems.
That's very astute, and yes, it's a good comparison. Zonulin, it's quite a substance. So we eat a food, we eat potato salad at a picnic, and it's been out in the sun too long, and there's some excess bacteria that's grown in the potato salad. How come 7 people get sick and 20 people don't? And they all ate the potato salads, because those 7 people, their immune systems weren't strong enough to deal with it. For those that were, one of the mechanisms of the immune system is that when a bacteria or certain food allergens come up against the wall of the intestine, inside the lumen of the intestine, and they touch on the wall of the intestine, there's a message that comes through inside the walls into the intraepithelial area that says, hey, this bacteria is hanging out on the wall of the intestine. What should we do about it? A protein called zonulin splits the tight junctions and comes out into the lumen of the intestines. Zonulin then says, hi, Mr. Bacteria, how are you? Zonulin shakes hands with Mr. Bacteria, says, come on with me, let me take you in past this security guard here called the tight junctions. Zonulin brings that bacteria inside the cells of the intestine into what's called the intraepithelial layer, and zonulin, then tight junctions close, and then zonulin introduces that bacteria to zonulin's friend, NF-kappa-B. NF-kappa-B, which is the major amplifier of inflammation in the body, NF-kappa-B then shakes hands with zonulin and then fires a chemical bullet at the bacteria, which then destroys it. So zonulin is a messenger. Zonulin goes out into the lumen of the intestine, someone that's a potential invader or a threat, welcomes them in, brings them inside the lining of the intestines into the intraepithelial area, introduces that bacteria to NF-kappa-B. NF-kappa-B then fires a chemical bullet called a cytokine at the bacteria and destroys it.
It furthermore, the shrapnel from that firing has to be addressed, because when you once you fire that bullet, yes, you've destroyed the bacteria, but you've also created a ricochet effect with all kinds of cytokines now floating around and augmenting, sometimes improperly, the inflammatory response in the gut. And in certain people who have genetic vulnerabilities to develop autoimmunity, like, for example, Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, which my audience is quite familiar with, the exposure to NF-kappa-B's actions, in effect, primes them to go on and develop their own gut-related autoimmune colitis.
Well, that's true in excess, which is a problem in our culture, that normally there wouldn't be much shrapnel, and that wouldn't be a problem. But because we're exposed every day, multiple times a day, let's take an example of a gluten sensitivity. And when we eat wheat, gluten's a protein in wheat, when we eat wheat multiple times a day, so you have pancakes for breakfast, you have a sandwich for lunch, you have pasta for dinner, the next day you have toast for breakfast, you have a sandwich for lunch, you have croutons on your salad for dinner, we're exposed to wheat multiple times a day, every day. If you have a sensitivity to it, or to dairy, or to any other food that you might be allergic to, we're constantly activating zonulin activity, activating NF-kappa-B activity. So what's supposed to be a sentry that occasionally has to fire a high-powered rifle becomes almost, it sounds like a submachine gun, that it never stops. Just pop, 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 pop. It just keeps going all of the time because of the number of what are called antigens, what are called irritating or threatening agents that our immune system has to react to.
So a couple of things happen, one of which is that if you have a lot of zonulin or a lot of zonulin activity, because you've got a lot of antigens,
right,
you're opening those tight junctions a lot.
Right.
And don't they sort of get stuck open after a while?
Well, they actually do. And that's what that's where the majority of intestinal permeability occurs, is that you wear out. Think of like a elastic rubber band around both sides of the tight junction wall. So the tight junctions open, and then they get pulled back together again. They open, they allow zonulin out into the lumen of the intestines, and they close. Then zonulin grabs onto the invader. They open, they allow zonulin and the invader to go back in, and then they close. And these walls open, close, and they're not supposed to work 10, 20, 30 times a day, every day. So they're supposed to work on occasion, but because they're working so frequently, you wear out the elastic in the elastic band that pulls them back together. That's one of the mechanisms. And the result is you get these doors that don't close completely, and now you've got opened tight junctions, and that's where intestinal permeability can occur quite frequently.
Now, I was also fascinated in hearing the zonulin story to find that vitamin D is absolutely critical in maintaining those tight junctions. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Vitamin D is, it controls the tight junction proteins that close the doors back again, which is the rubber band. So when you have a vitamin D insufficiency or a vitamin D deficiency, you're very prone to developing intestinal permeability, which is a prerequisite that sets up the whole autoimmune process. That's one of the main mechanisms by which vitamin D is associated with the development of autoimmune disease. Vitamin D insufficiencies are associated with the development of autoimmune diseases.
Now, I've been putting just about all of my patients on vitamin D if they have any autoimmune disease for about a year now. I've yet to find an autoimmune patient who doesn't have low vitamin D when I've tested.
Yes.
So I've gotten to the point where I'm just dosing everyone. My question for you is, what do you think is an appropriate vitamin D level to be shooting for in people who have active autoimmune disease, where you're seeking to interrupt this vicious cycle?
It's a good question. Studies have now come out that show that anytime you're below 50 nanograms per milliliter, you're much more prone to developing autoimmune diseases. So our guidelines now are between 50 and 100 nanograms. That's the goal to be in. The Vitamin D Council, and it's a really good website to visit, vitamindcouncil.com, they advocate, I believe it's 50 to 85 nanograms per milliliter. So we're in that range, somewhere between 40, 45, 50, up to 85 and 100 nanograms.
Right. And to give someone that kind of a level almost always requires some level of supplementation.
Yes, it does, because there's not that much vitamin D in food. There's a little, but not very much. And we're so sun phobic. Many of us live in areas of the country where the sun just isn't out often enough, or it's not powerful enough to give us a stimulation of vitamin D production in our skin, or we've become so sun phobic. Michael Hollick, very famous medical doctor, PhD, who I believe has been on your show, Dr. Hollick talks about how the sun is our friend and stop being phobic about it. A couple thousand people a year die from the lifetime effects of too much sun. That's true. A couple thousand people a year from a lifetime of too much sun. But hundreds of thousands of people die every year from not enough sun. So get a grip. Get a grip. Learn how to use the sun appropriately and not overexposure to the sun. It's Dr. Hollick's message. When do I put lotion on? How do I read the label on the lotion? What type of lotion should I use? How much should I apply? How long do I stay in the sun before I apply lotion? All of that is laid out, I believe, at thevitamindcouncil.com and in Dr. Hollick's book, The UV Advantage, which it's an excellent book for giving us guidelines on how to follow using the sun properly.
And I think it's important to state that Dr. Hollick's work is highly evidence-based.
Yes.
And there is a reference for every declarative sentence.
Yes.
And that has been, I think, one of the reasons that we are finally getting to see some movement in the medical community, even in the recommendations for nutritional supplementation that are coming out from the most conservative organizations.
Yes.
Vitamin D supplementation has tripled.
Kudos to Dr. Hollick for being on the cutting edge and standing out there and being willing to be labeled as a fanatic within traditional medical circles. He's just a first-tier researcher and highly respected by many, and those that didn't agree with nutrition now have no choice but to recognize the critical importance of vitamin D. Kudos to Dr. Hollick for that.
Indeed. There are a number of things about that modern lifestyle that are old traditional bits of good health advice that keep coming back around. Get plenty of sleep, control your stress. And you spent some time talking about a book recently published called The Blue Zone, I believe?
Yes. It came out in October or November of last year, 2008. We know that there are cultures in the world where a large percentage of the people, octogenarians, nonagenarians, centurions, they live into their 80s, 90s, over 100, fully functional in life, fully functional, well-functioning brains, active, physically active people, valued members of society. They're not put out to rest in a nursing home, put out to pasture. They're valued members of society. We know of these cultures. They're in Okinawa, Sardinia, Costa Rica. They call them blue zones. And the reason they call them blue zones is because as researchers were studying them, they put a big map of the world on there, and they circled the areas of where there were high percentages of these elders who were fully functional, and they use a blue highlighter. So they call them blue zones because they use a blue highlighter. You know, that little trivia is kind of cute. But they're called blue zones. And they found a blue zone right here in the U.S., right here in California, actually, outside of L.A. L.A., where if you're a runner or a jogger and you go out and run 6.2 miles, you get as much toxins as if you smoked a pack of cigarettes. L.A. And they found a blue zone outside of L.A. in a town called Loma Linda, where a large percentage of the people live into their 80s and 90s and over 100, just like in Costa Rica and Okinawa and Sardinia. And Loma Linda, it was the Seventh-day Adventists that they apparently have a lifestyle, not apparently, they do, have a lifestyle that encourages longevity and vitality in their elder years. And the book, The Blue Zone, this so startled researchers that there was a group in a civilized industrial country that had the same high percentage of elders as those living in the third world countries in the mountains of Sardinia, or way back in the jungles of Costa Rica, or way back in the on the island of Okinawa, away from the major cities. But here we had a group living outside of L.A. that had the same numbers. They went in and they looked at them, and they wanted to find out, why did this happen? What's common to all of these groups, irrespective of whether they're industrialized or third world? What did these people have in common? And they found that there were 9 factors that were common to all of these civilizations.
Of the 9 factors, and they're things you've heard before, folks, be part of a community, meditate, get yourself calm, get regular exercise, eat lots of fruits and vegetables. In the case of Seventh-day Adventists, they are vegetarians, but that isn't the case of all of the Blue Zone cultures. Let's look at those Blue Zone qualities in reference to autoimmune disease and kind of walk through how they alter the natural history of these pumped up people who are already maybe showing some antibodies. And we'll get to antibody testing of pre-disease and the implications for motivating a patient to clean up their act lifestyle-wise in a minute. But I'd like just to talk about the mechanisms. So for example, a diet high in fruits and vegetables. Why is that helpful in autoimmune disease? What are the mechanisms there?
Good. Well, they call that plant slant, that these diets were slanted towards fresh fruits and vegetables. And although the book didn't say this, what I add for my patients is always 5 different colors. Always different colors. You don't just want to eat a bag of carrots. You want to have different colors because every color is a different family of antioxidants. And in these third world countries, the plants they were eating, the vegetables they were eating, were those that were growing at that time. So they were always varied. One of the reasons, one of the mechanisms by which it helps, we know that intestinal permeability is one of the mechanisms that make one vulnerable, one of the 3 criteria for autoimmune disease. And how do you heal the gut? How do you have a healthy gut? How do you produce healthier cells in the gut? The cells of the gut are called colonocytes, and they're the fastest growing cells in the body. Every 3 to 7 days, you have a new lining to your intestines. And the fuel for those cells is called butyrate or butyric acid. And if you have low butyrate levels, then the cells that you make every 3 to 7 days, you make your house out of straw instead of out of brick. And so you get weakened cells. That's why low butyrate levels are associated with a higher risk of colon cancers. Well, the production of butyrate, how do you get enough butyrate in your body? Butyrate is produced by the action of the probiotics, the good bacteria, on vegetable fiber. So if you're not getting enough vegetable fiber, you can't produce enough butyrate to make healthy cells to help to heal your gut.
And the butyrate itself is actually produced by probiotics.
That's right, by the action of probiotics on vegetable fiber.
Now, is that why fermented foods like kimchi and cauliflower are supposed to be good for healing the gut because they already contain a lot of butyrate? Or
I don't know that. That's a really good premise, and that may be the case. I haven't seen any studies on that. One of the benefits of fermented vegetables is that they encourage, they're called a prebiotic, that they help the probiotics to flourish. So as a result of that, you get better colonization, higher colonization, and more adherence of the probiotics to the intestinal wall when you have enough prebiotics with it. But the idea that prebiotics may have butyrate or butyric acid in it may be true. I just don't know.
Okay. One of the other things in the Blue Zone rules were eat 20% less.
Yes, hara hachibu, eat 20% less. All of these people eat simply, and they don't eat very much, and they eat regularly. Eating 20% less means they're always just a little bit, not quite on the hungry side, but just not full. They just don't get satiated the way we so commonly do in our culture today. And part of the premise why I think we do that, my own theory, is that when we were children, if we were crying, our mothers would run into the room to see what was wrong when we were infants. And if they couldn't find out what was wrong, what would mom do? She'd give us a bottle, or she'd give us a cookie. So we began associating emotional trauma, maybe a bird flew by the window and scared us, with oral gratification, that we start eating to suppress the emotional trauma. And I believe that carries over into our adulthood, and one of the reasons why many of us eat to satiation, to where we're over full. But eating 20% less and always being a little bit on the just enough side, we know that that's one consistent way that always extends lifespan of test animals. That's one you can always count on. You're going to extend their lifespans by up to 30% when you feed them a little bit less.
Does it also have an effect in terms of being anti-inflammatory, or rather avoiding being pro-inflammatory?
Correct.
Because when you eat a lot, particularly if there's fat, isn't that directly inflammatory and could essentially upregulate the immune response?
Absolutely. A high-fat meal always increases the inflammatory cascade. You get more inflammation from eating a high-fat meal. And I don't know if that's limited to just transformed fatty acids or bad fats or any fats. The studies just say high-fat meal.
Well, it probably means a lot of fat calories, and there's probably a healthy threshold for the amount of fat calories that our body can handle.
That's a very good
at
point.
Any given moment, and that's what a high-fat test meal crosses, is that threshold.
That's a very good point. Yes, I think you're right there.
There's a lot of psychological stuff that is in common with the blue groups. The idea of having quiet time, some contemplation, having a purpose in life, having a place in the tribe, being in a community, being with one's loved ones. All of these things are going to evoke the tend and mend parasympathetic response psychologically. And that has some effects on the immune system and the intestines as well, does it not?
A tremendous amount of impact. What surprised me about that is that some of these elders that they interviewed were cantankerous. They weren't easygoing, mellow people. They were don't bother me kind of people. But within their circle of friends, they're very close and intimate. But you know, we think of these elders who have quiet time in their lives, that they're going to be mellow, almost like yogis that we can sit at their feet and learn from. And some of them are fairly cantankerous in the book, which was very surprising to see. Then I laugh because I think, well, they've got juice. You know, they've got their own way of looking at life that doesn't exclude others, that they are part of the community. That's a very important point. They're part of the community. And yes, I do believe that they find peace in how they've developed their lifestyle, which stimulates parasympathetic dominance, which produces endorphins and enkephalons, 200 times more powerful than morphine, which just nourishes us with the message, thrive, relax, be happy, which is what parasympathetic dominance does.
Another factor in the blue group was exercise.
Yes.
And I was very pleased to see in your case studies that you presented at your conference today that you emphasized exercise as a prescription, as part of the plan, and actually gave people, here's your dose of exercise, here's your daily dose of exercise. It's just as important as your supplements.
Right.
And it needs to be part of your life if you're going to avoid the progression of your autoimmune disease or hopefully even reverse your autoimmune disease. And we'll talk about some of your successful reversals in thyroid autoimmune disease because I found that extremely encouraging.
Yes, yes, exercise is critical. And the form of exercise is not as important as the intensity of exercise. That many of us in this culture, we exercise way too hard and we're pushing ourselves. A couple of indicators of that are, are you tired after you've exercised? If you are, you've pushed too hard. Or is your pulse up the next morning? Is your resting pulse elevated? You pushed too hard the day before. The studies say 150 minutes a week of aerobic exercise is the goal that we want. And Mrs. Patient, it may take you 6 months or a year to get there. Maybe you can only do 10 minutes a day right now. That's fine, do 10 minutes. Next week, you're going to do 15 minutes a day. And the week after that, you'll do 20 minutes a day. That you don't have to try and be perfect right away. You just have to have the vision of where you're going to.
I was extremely excited to hear that we are very close to being able to test people for many of these autoimmune markers that are the early markers. And you made the point that we now know that autoimmune disease and the formation of these autoimmune markers occurs in a stepwise fashion. So there are, in effect, early and late markers for autoimmune disorders such as lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. Some of these have a very, very high predictive value. If you have these markers and nothing is done, you have a 90% or even 100% chance of developing clinical autoimmune disease in X amount of time, usually in the range of 8 to 10 years. And there are studies that back up all of these, and I'm sure many markers that have not yet emerged. But where do you see us going clinically in terms of the functional medicine physical? When someone comes in and they have a family history of autoimmune disease, maybe they have a sibling with type 1 diabetes and a mother with autoimmune thyroid disease, which would be a very common profile. So I'm concerned about autoimmune disease in this individual. And I want to see, I want to go fishing and see if we need to make any changes for them.
Yes, that's a very good question. And it's an exciting time because, well, it's going to depend on what the patient wants. If the patient wants symptom relief, if that's their primary concern, then a functional medicine approach that looks at what triggered their symptoms, which is what many of us are doing now, is very, very valuable. And the symptom relief will occur. Plus, they'll get so many side benefits. They lose weight. They have more energy. They feel better. Their headaches are gone or whatever the symptom was they came in with. But there is a percentage of people, especially as the baby boomers are coming into their senior years, that want to know, what disease am I targeted to get here? And technology, there was an article in Scientific American in March of 2007, the cover of Scientific American entitled Predicting Disease. Mm-hmm. And researchers from UCLA talked about how these antibodies are produced years ahead of time. Let's say the antibodies to lupus, in the example you gave of lupus. The antibodies are produced at a certain level, and they keep climbing every year, every year, every year. This is the blood test, if you happen to have a blood test looking for lupus antibodies, where it come back and say they're in the normal range. And then they keep climbing and climbing and climbing and climbing until they get to a certain threshold. And at that threshold, tissue damage occurs. Now, antibodies against your tissue are firing cytokines, chemical bullets, at the tissue, destroying the tissue. Why would we ever want any antibodies attacking our tissue? Any whatsoever. The study that started all of this in 2003 in the New England Journal of Medicine by Arbuckle. Arbuckle went to the VA hospital and looked for people who had been diagnosed with lupus. She then went back and looked at their blood samples that the VA, the Veterans Administration, had in their frozen storage banks from years and years and years earlier. So if you were a vet, you were in the armed forces earlier in life. And if you were in the armed forces earlier in life, you had blood draws for something. Maybe there was an outbreak of mono on the base. You had a blood draw to see if you were vulnerable to mono. Or maybe you got a check to see what your cholesterol levels are, for whatever reason. The armed forces, they keep all that blood. It's frozen. They keep it all. There's millions and millions of samples of blood now that they've got in their blood banks. So Arbuckle took people who currently were diagnosed with lupus. And she went back, she looked at their blood draws from years ago. And maybe they had a blood draw for mononucleosis. It came back negative. Well, they kept the blood. So she got that blood and she looked to see, were there any antibodies to lupus in there? Well, back at the time, they didn't look for antibodies to lupus. They looked for mono. So she looked for antibodies to lupus. And what she found out, that up to 9 years earlier, those antibodies were there. And she did her grafts from 6 years. And she showed that from 6 years, the level of antibodies kept climbing every year. More and more and more antibodies, firing chemical bullets, cytokines that are destroying tissue, more of them, while they're in the so-called normal range, until they hit a certain threshold where they were elevated at a point, and now the symptoms were present. And when the symptoms were present, it took about 6 months before they got the diagnosis of lupus, and the antibodies plateaued right there. So they got that certain stage where there's enough organ damage that's accumulated over time. The antibody load was so high now, and here come the symptoms because of the organ damage, and then they get the diagnosis of lupus. But the antibodies were there years beforehand. That was the initial article in 2003 that I read that got me interested in this field. As a result of that article, I started reading more, and what we now have that's just come out is that predictive antibodies can tell us. They've done enough research now, and they've gone back and looked far enough with so many different autoimmune diseases that we know if you have the antibodies, any antibodies, to a particular autoimmune disease, they can tell now what the positive predictive value is that you're going to get that disease. For example, with thyroid, if you have TPO, thyroid peroxidase antibodies, it's a 92% positive predictive value. You're going to get Hashimoto's thyroiditis within 7 years. 9 out of 10 people with those antibodies in the, quote, normal range are going to get Hashimoto's. If you have antibodies to transglutaminase or endomysium, the antibodies you look for with celiac disease, it's a 46 to 50% likelihood you're going to get celiac in 7 years. However, if you also have the gene for celiac disease, it's a 100% you're getting the disease within 7 years. With Saccharomyces cerevisiae antibodies, it's an antibody. Saccharomyces cerevisiae is a yeast that's normal in a woman's reproductive tract. It's supposed to be there, but it's not supposed to be in the intestines. So if you have antibodies in the intestines, the Saccharomyces cerevisiae, it's a 100% positive predictive value. You're going to get Crohn's within 3 years. So the studies have now come out that say antibodies tell us where this patient's body is going, what tissues are being damaged, what tissues are being destroyed. So that gives us a window to calm down that autoimmune process, to try and turn around the direction that person's body is going in before so much of the organ has been destroyed. They now get the symptoms and they get the diagnosis of autoimmune disease.
So beyond the things in the blue zone information, which we've talked about already, what are your therapeutic mainstays in calming down the system so that you can prevent the progression of autoimmune disease, or at least hope to do so?
Primary is heal the gut. You've got to heal intestinal permeability. That's the first thing. And all functional medicine practitioners have been trained on how to heal the gut. You want to look to see what's the milieu of the gut. What's the environment of the gut? Do you have enough of the probiotics, the good guys there? Do you have any bacteria? Do you have enough digestive enzyme production occurring? All of the mechanisms of function of the gut are critical because all of those, any of those or all of those, can contribute to or cause intestinal permeability, leaky gut. So you want to heal the gut always. And there are foundational nutrients that are recommended to heal the gut, and then there are many secondary nutrients that also work to heal the gut.
Get a little specific for us. You talked about probiotics. You talked about prebiotics. Everyone gets vitamin D?
Vitamin D is critical. Vitamin D is critical to healing the gut. Glutamine, critical to healing the gut. Curcumin from turmeric, critical to healing the gut. Fish oils, critical to healing the gut. These are the essentials, what I call the foundational nutrients to use. And then depending on the doctor and what their postgraduate studies have been and their experiences in practice, they may include other things also. But these are the ones that there are numerous studies to show they have tremendous benefit in healing the gut and reducing the inflammatory cascade that's going on.
Would you also include green tea as one of those foundational nutrients?
Green tea, there are some studies that have come out that and show green tea is very helpful and effective at arresting the autoimmune process. It's not a foundational item in healing the gut. It would be a secondary item in calming down the fire, but not so much in stimulating healing, as far as I know.
There were a couple of other diseases, not strictly speaking autoimmune, but inflammatory diseases that came up in the course of our discussion today. And one of them that I thought most people will be surprised about was the osteoporosis connection with activated NF-kappa B.
Yes.
Could you address that for just a moment? I have so many people calling me every week with questions about osteoporosis, and this was something I had not heard before, and I think it's very important to get out to my audience.
Critically important. There are two factors about osteoporosis that are fairly new for most people that are critically important. In the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2006, the researcher said, we have no hesitancy in saying that we recommend every patient with osteopenia or osteoporosis must be checked for celiac disease, as celiac disease could be the cause of their osteoporosis. So whenever you have a patient that has weakened bone or low bone density, we always want to check for gluten sensitivity. That's the first. The second thing is that receptor sites are the mechanism by which substances get into cells, hormones get inside cells. And there's a receptor site called RANKL, stands for receptor for NF-kappa B. RANKL is a receptor site. NF-kappa B is the major amplifier of inflammation in the body. I like to think about garage bands. And that back in the old days, we had garage bands. Why did you have to go out in the garage to play music? Because it was too loud and your parents threw you out of the house. They said, go out in the garage and do this. So we would have garage bands. And we'd want the biggest amplifiers we could get to kick out as loud a music as we could. So NF-kappa B is the amplifier for inflammation in the body. And when you have any inflammatory trigger causing inflammation, you increase NF-kappa B. And when you have NF-kappa B circulating through the bloodstream, we now know there are receptor sites on the bone cells called osteoblasts for NF-kappa B. So when you get inflammation coming into the body, it binds to the receptor site on the osteoblast, the cell that makes new bone cells, and it converts that osteoblast into osteoclast to stimulate more bone destruction. So inflammation is a common mechanism of osteoporosis. And you want to have an anti-inflammatory lifestyle in order to reduce NF-kappa B.
Fascinating. It's all connected.
Yes, it is.
So difficult to get your mind around that when you've been trained to break things down. Putting them all back together is just...
Oh my goodness, yes.
It's just crazy.
And calcium is important, of course. Calcium's important for bone health. But we know now that the drugs that make stronger bone, the bisphosphonates that make stronger bone, they make more bone, but it's not stronger bone. The x-rays show that there's more bone, but the bone is balsa wood instead of oak. And the people that take these bisphosphonates have just as many fractures in osteoporosis as people that don't take bisphosphonates and get fractures with osteoporosis. The number is not statistically different.
Now, that's interesting. I think there probably have been studies published that did show statistical difference. Maybe they were methodologically flawed, or maybe the drug companies cherry-picked them.
Well, the studies show that you make more bone. And the x-rays show that.
No, I think there's, not to argue, but I do believe I've seen published data looking at fracture rates.
Oh.
And so...
they may be cherry-picking. You're right.
You know, we can obviously agree to disagree on that. But
right, right.
Nonetheless, I think it's an extremely important point that we'd prefer not to break down perfectly good bone
right.
in excess and replace it with something artificial that hasn't been fully studied. I want to ask you about the dairy and the type 1 diabetes. You made a comment when we were talking about the oral tolerance issues and how certain foods can cause people to develop autoimmune disease. And the comment was about type 1 diabetes in children and the risk of that being greatly increased by the introduction of milk protein in the first year of life.
Yes.
Now that's good solid data, correct?
Yes.
What's the putative mechanism for that?
The suspected mechanism, the one that they've written about quite a bit, is called cellular mimicry. And cellular mimicry means that you make antibodies. Well, let's take the example of wheat. The molecule in wheat that most often the body makes antibodies to is called gliadin. That's a protein that's in wheat when the wheat is not digested completely in the intestines. Proteins are made up of amino acids, and the goal of digestion is to break up proteins into individual amino acids that get absorbed into the bloodstream. When you can't digest it completely, you make fragments of amino acids, and those are called peptides. And sometimes a small peptide can be absorbed into the bloodstream. It's not a problem at all. But many of the proteins don't get fully digested into small individual amino acids that get absorbed, but rather, in the case of wheat, into this 33 amino acid peptide called gliadin. The immune system makes antibodies to gliadin. And if I describe that peptide as AABCD, the letters are for the different amino acid sequences that make up that peptide, and it's 33 amino acids long, but I'll just say AABCD. On the surface of your thyroid, facing the bloodstream, the surface of the thyroid is made up of proteins and fats. The proteins are hundreds of amino acids long, sometimes 50 amino acids, sometimes 150 amino acids, depending on which protein it is. There are multiple amino acids that make up that specific protein. Some of those amino acid proteins include the sequence within it of AABCD. So the immune system, making antibodies to the protein in wheat called gliadin, AABCD, sees AABCD on the surface of the thyroid and fires a chemical bullet at the thyroid tissue to destroy what it thinks is a gliadin molecule. The result of that is that you damage the thyroid tissue because you fired a cytokine, a chemical bullet at it, and then the body is always getting rid of damaged tissue to replace it with new tissue, so the body makes antibodies to thyroid tissue now. Now, it wouldn't be a big deal if it happened once, but because we're eating wheat all the time, making antibodies all the time to wheat, AABCD, you've got AABCD firing at your thyroid, damaging thyroid cells quite regularly, and now you make antibodies to your thyroid. Now you have an autoimmune mechanism against your thyroid. And even if you stop eating wheat, you've got this antibody production against your thyroid that just keeps going on its own. That's called cellular mimicry. That's the most commonly accepted mechanism. There are six mechanisms, but that's the most commonly accepted one.
So in reference to the cow's milk, is mechanism that's place with the pancreas?
Yes, that's exactly what's happened. The cow's milk protein is similar in structure to the beta cells of the pancreas. And when the body makes antibodies to cow's milk protein, it will then often attack the beta cells of the pancreas. And when you destroy the beta cells of the pancreas, you no longer make insulin. And now you develop diabetes. And that's why kids get diagnosed between the ages of 8 and 14 with type 1 diabetes, because it takes that many years to destroy the beta cells of the pancreas. What scientists now know is that exposure to dairy in the first year of life, especially for African Americans, they're even much more vulnerable to this. But all groups, exposure to dairy in the first year of life will trigger the production of antibodies to dairy, which then can trigger the AABCD syndrome against the beta cells of the pancreas. There's the child that gets diagnosed with type 1 diabetes between the ages of 8 and 14.
So I have three children. One of them has type 1 diabetes. The other two do not. I am having my fourth now. You would actually give me some specific advice. What would it be?
Test the children. Test them for antibodies to the beta cells of the pancreas, the type 1 diabetes antibodies. And there is no normal range for antibodies to your pancreas. Now, the labs will tell you and the doctors will tell you, well, it's normal to be in that range. No, it's not. The new studies have come out and show the positive predictive value if you've got any of these antibodies, how long before you're going to develop the disease. So if your child has any of these antibodies, that gives you the opportunity to begin a lifestyle to calm down the inflammation that's going on for them.
So I would want to avoid milk, cow's milk.
You would
milk.
Want to avoid dairy, and then you would want to look for, if they've got the antibodies, they've got intestinal permeability, so you want to go through the protocol to heal the gut. Always want to do that. And then if their antibody load initially was negative, they have no antibodies, that's wonderful, breathe a sigh of relief, and check them next year. And you have to check them every year, and the scientists, the researchers don't say in the papers how long, they just say you check them annually. So it may be until they're 15 or 20. There are some people that get diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in their 20s. So you would want to check them regularly for quite a while to make sure there are no antibodies that are forming. And because that child is in a family where there is a history of type 1 diabetes, you want to educate that child and guide them in what we call a blue zone lifestyle.
Certainly easier when you catch them young.
That's right. That's right. It is. Before the disease has manifested itself.
Now, I first got creeped out about BPA early, about 4 or 5 years ago when the initial studies came out. And then, of course, there was that huge study last year looking at the probability that run it through a dishwasher, run it through a microwave, let it sit in the car, and you're leaching. So I think most of my listeners are pretty aware of that. But you brought up the point that whenever we go out and buy a hot beverage at a coffee shop, that the plastic lid contains BPA.
Oh, yes. Anytime you've got soft plastic that bends, it's got BPA in it. So when you put this lid on a coffee cup, the heat of the coffee causes some steam to come up. The steam condenses on the underside of the lid, and that liquid drips back down into the coffee with BPA in it. And then you take that hot liquid and you run it up to your lips right past the opening in the soft plastic, so you get more BPA exposure from that. And we're getting exposed to BPA in tremendously high dosages every day.
Well, you said 150 micrograms a day. And if that's the case, and we're postulating that BPA is equivalent in potency to estrogen, that's a postmenopausal hormone supplement dose.
That's exactly right. Molecule for molecule. The Journal of the American Medical Association came out with a paper just last year. Molecule for molecule, it's as potent as estradiol, the most potent of estrogens.
And I also found out that my soft contact lenses contain BPA.
That's correct.
Dental sealants, the resin inside of cans.
Right, carbonless paper, so credit card receipts.
Credit card receipts.
Right.
And the hand sterilizer's not going to help you there.
Right.
In fact, I bet the hand sterilizer's full of BPA because those containers are soft plastic.
Soft plastic. Right, that's exactly right.
I know.
It's so prevalent in our culture. And we wonder why hormone-related cancers are as high as they are.
There is a paper that you cite that says that this may be part of why we're seeing so much diabetes in young children. Can you explain the mechanism of that?
Right. Bisphenol A inhibits the production of adiponectins, which are produced in the fatty tissue of the midsection. And adiponectins are good guys. They're anti-inflammatory lectins. And BPA inhibits the production of that. So these kids have less anti-inflammatory compounds being produced that specifically help with the use of insulin and stabilizing blood sugar. So as a result of that, these kids have much higher incidence of sugar sensitivity, insulin resistance, and type 2 diabetes. Metabolic syndrome, which leads to type 2 diabetes.
As a close, I'd like you to talk about the lovely story you tell about dose response at Dairy Queen.
Oh, that's a good, I've used that for years with my patients, you know. You take your child, your four-year-old child, to the Dairy Queen. It's a hot summer night. Family's going out for an ice cream. And your child gets a small in a cone. That small is two scoops of ice cream. Your four-year-old child weighs 40 pounds. Let's say 35 pounds. Dad weighs 190 pounds. So the little child getting two scoops of Dairy Queen at 35 to 40 pounds is the same as dad getting 9 to 10 scoops of ice cream at 185 to 90 pounds. So if dad eats 9 to 10 scoops of ice cream, what's dad going to feel like later? What's that doing to his blood sugar? We don't think to ration by weight the dosage of sugar that we take in or the dosage of nutrients that we take in, but in this case, sugars. So we're poisoning our kids with so much sugar before their system is mature enough to handle those levels. It's hard for an adult to handle two scoops of ice cream without having a blood sugar reaction. And when you give it to a child, you're throwing their system so far out of balance, you're almost ensuring they're going to have blood sugar instability in their lives. Not just from one Dairy Queen, obviously, but because in our lives, we give them cookies, we give them a bottle of pop, we give them so much Kool-Aid, we give them so much fruit juice. Just talk about fruit juices and excess fruit juices causing type 2 diabetes in these kids by the time they're 15, 20. You know, when I came out in practice, it was adult onset diabetes was in your 50s and 60s. Now it's when you're 15 and 16 because of what we fed these kids and how we've weakened their genetics as a result of how we lived our lives.
It can't be just diet, though. There's really been a fundamental physiologic change, and so I'm looking for the hidden X factor, high fructose corn syrup, BPA is another candidate now.
Well, I would suggest they're not candidates. I would suggest they're participants. So that it's clear that BPA contributes to blood sugar instability and vulnerability to metabolic syndrome. And it's clear that we know high fructose corn syrup does that. The studies are very clear on this. And so I guess the message is it's the gestalt of how we live our lives and all of the influences we take in of things that we know we're not supposed to do. We're not supposed to do this, and we know that, but we do it anyway because we think it's okay. And we don't think about the cumulative effect of all of these pieces of the puzzle and how it ends up presenting the body that we walk into our doctors with today.
And that brings us around full circle to the fundamental principles of functional medicine, which are we are an ecology.
That's
with
right.
Environmental inputs, with weak spots and strong spots, and the great cycle of our existence is informed by our biochemistry and our behavior and our genetics, and it's all one big package.
It is. You know, maybe the last analogy I'd like to give is when you're sitting in the airport about to take off, and you're in an airplane, you have a window seat, you're looking out the window, and you're looking at the environment. All you can see is the plane next door to you. You really don't know what the environment has around you. And when the plane taxis and goes down the runway, you can see, oh, look, there's some trees over there. The plane takes off. It starts to go up in the air. You're at 100 feet. You can see a little bit further. You get up around 500 feet. You can see the airport now and all the runways of the airport. You get up to a few thousand feet. You can see the surrounding terrain a bit. You get up to 30,000 feet, and you see the big picture. I think the success of a functional medicine practitioner in getting their patients to comply with the recommendations is that we help our patients get a 30,000-foot view of why they walked in with this symptom, whatever it should be. They have to step away from it and get up at 30,000-foot level to see all of the different components that contributed to it so that they can understand and then embrace the concept of what we call a blue zone lifestyle.
Dr. O'Brien, I think I can say on behalf of my audience that we certainly see why you have such a prominent role in educating practitioners about functional medicine. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.